second shiur, the second class in a series of lectures focusing on biblical scandals and the messianic dynasty. Last week we spoke about Lot and the incest with his daughters, and we tried to do well and defend his daughters. Lot, not so much. I refer you back to the class. You can find it online if you'd like. I'm happy to send the link. And this morning, we're going to focus on Tamar and Yehuda. I had originally intended to focus on Rachel and Leah and the switch that happened at their marriage, and in general, how could Yaakov marry two sisters? But somebody came over to me after the class last week and said, how can you give a class on biblical scandals and not talk about David and Bathsheba? Which was a good point. So I decided to change the syllabus. So this week, we're going to talk about Tamar and Yehuda. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, we're back to 10 o'clock, and we will talk about David and Bathsheba, as much as one can talk about in one class, we'll jam it in. And then for the fourth class, we will talk about the more general topic of why does there need to be so many scandals surrounding the birth of David and ultimately the birth of the Messiah of Mashiach. But for today, we're going to focus on Tamar and Yehuda. And as I entitled the sheets, Tamar Yehuda and the Seeds of Mashiach. By way of introduction, I want to share with you a medrash, a very powerful medrash. What we're going to be looking at this morning is Perek Lam and Ches. Last week we spoke about Perek Yotes, the 19th chapter in the book of Genesis. And this morning we're going to be talking about the 38th chapter of the book of Genesis. But if you would sort of zero out and look more globally at where we stand right now in Bereshis, we're in a very dark period. The previous chapter, Joseph was sold. So Baruch Hashem, we know the story ends well. But for the players in the story themselves, they didn't know that to be the case at all. Yaakov Avinu is in mourning for a son that he doesn't know he will see again. At the time, Yaakov thinks his son was lost, never to be retrieved ever again. And we pick up Perek Lam and Ches in really a tremendously dark period in Jewish history. And here is where the Medrash steps in. In source number one, Vayihi ba'eis hahi, which are the opening words of our chapter that we are going to read today. And it was at that time, Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman Pasach. So Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman, when he would teach chapter 38, Bereshis Lam and Ches, he would start with the Pasuk in Yirmiyah. The Pasuk can be read in full in source number 2. Yirmiyahu says, Ki anochi yadati es hamacha shavos, asher anochi choshev aleichem ne'um Hashem. God says, I know the true intentions, I know the good thoughts of the Jewish people. Macha shavos, shalom. They are thoughts of peace. V'lo lira'ah. They are not thoughts of evil intent. L'aseis lachem acharis v'tikva. To give the people hope and longing. In other words, what the prophet Jeremiah is saying is that God knows, not necessarily, well, he knows everything, but the focus is not so much on our intentions, but rather on God's intentions. And God's intentions are for the good. God's intentions are in order to give people peace and longevity and hope. What does that have to do with anything? So look at what this rabbi would say after drawing upon this pasuk, talking about how God's intentions are for the good. Do we have more? I ran out. We'll make more for next week. We could all share. I'm sorry for underselling how many people would be here. Baruch Hashem, such a beautiful crowd. So listen to what the Medrash says. Shvatim hayu asukin b'mechiraso shel Yosef. The tribes were busy selling Joseph. V'Yosef haya asuk b'saka uvitaniso. Yosef himself was wearing sackcloth and was fasting. He was on his way down to Egypt. Reuven haya asuk b'sako v'taniso. Reuven, who completely disappointed his father by not being able to return Yosef back. Yaakov just said to Yosef, go check on your brothers. And Yosef never returned. So who is the one held accountable for that? It's the Bechor, it's the oldest one, it's Reuven. So Reuven was sitting with his sackcloth and fasting. V'Yaakov haya asuk b'sako v'taniso. Yaakov too was sitting with his sackcloth and in a fast. V'Yehuda haya asuk likach lo isha. Yehuda was busy finding a wife, and that's the chapter that we're about to read, and it does not go well. It was a very, very dark moment in Jewish history. But listen to how the Medrash ends off. HaKadosh Baruch Hu haya osik bore oro shel melech hamashiach. But Hashem was sitting there creating the light for Mashiach. So in other words, the chapter that we're about to read, as dark as it may be, and as a difficult chapter as this is for the Jewish people, a small people at the time, but as difficult as it was, God was sitting there creating the light for Mashiach. So that's the Medrash saying that you have to look deeper and have a broader context when reading this particular chapter, because ultimately, this chapter is creating the light of Mashiach. A very powerful Medrash to start out our study. So now let's jump right in. Part number one, setting the stage. Let's look at this chapter. We could have many, many classes on this chapter. We are not going to. We're going to do our best to analyze the Perek in one class. And we're going to read through the verses at a pretty swift pace. And then we'll analyze at a slower pace. So the Torah tells us in source number one, Vayihi ba'eis hahi, and it was at that time coming off of the sale of Joseph. Vayered Yehuda me'eis achav. Yehuda goes down from his brethren, whether or not that's a reference to a geographic location that is south, or maybe it's more of a global reflection on the fact that Yehuda, who made the recommendation to sell Yosef, was sort of demoted. Because the brothers thought it was a good idea at the time, but when they come back and they see how much their father's suffering, they realize Yehuda was not advising them well. So there are multiple ways of reading that that phrase, Vayered Yehuda me'eis achav. Yehuda went down from his brothers. And probably the answer is it's both correct. In other words, he went geographically south, he went down, but also he received somewhat of a demotion in the eyes of his brothers. Vayet ad ish adulami ushmo Chira. He goes and he lives next to somebody by the name of Chira. Vayar sham Yehuda bas ish Kanani. Yehuda sees the daughter of a Canaanite man, ushmo Shua. The Canaanite man's name was Shua. Vayikacheha, he takes the daughter, vayavo Allah, and he has relations with her. Vatahar vateled ben, he conceives with this woman. They have a child, a boy. Vayikrat shemo Er. That's the name of the first son. He was a young, a wonderful young man. He was a breath of fresh air. Sorry, that was a bad joke. Vatahar od vateled ben. They have another child. Vatikrat shemo Onan. So the second boy is named Onan. Vatosef od vateled ben. They have another child. Vatikrat shemo Shela. Vayhi bechaziv bilidata oso. And they were in this location called Kaziv when they gave birth to the third son. So they have three boys: Er, Onan, and Shela. Vayikach Yehuda Isha Le'er Bechoro. So many years pass by, and the scholars debate when this story actually took place. Did it take place prior to the sale of Yosef? Did it take place only after Yosef was sold? Clearly the Torah places it after the sale of Yosef. Whether or not it chronologically took place at that time is subject to debate beyond the scope of our discussion. The bottom line is, Er grows up, and Yehuda takes a wife for his son. Vayikach Yehuda Isha Le'er Bechoro, Ushma Tamar. This is where Tamar enters the stage as the wife of Yehuda's oldest son. Vayhi Er Bechor Yehuda Ra Beinei Hashem. But Er is not a good man in the eyes of God. Vayimasehu Hashem. And God kills him off. What did he do that was so bad? We don't know. It tells us simply that he was bad in the eyes of the Almighty. We don't know more information than that. The Torah goes on. Vayomer Yehuda le'onan. So Yehuda turns to his second son and he says, Bo el isha sachicha vayivamem osa. Go and live with your brother's widow. What we would call in English the Levirate marriage. We know of Yibum. Interesting, the Torah wasn't given. The formal mitzvah of Yibam did not exist, but Yehuda somehow recognized that it was the right thing to do. We'll talk more about that. And the benefit of the benefit of Onan marrying, if you will, his older brother's widow is Vahakem Zera L'Achicha. And at least there will be some progeny for your brother. Your brother died without having children, you, as the second son, will marry your older brother's widow and will have children through this line. Vayeda Onan ki lo yehazara. And Onan said, what do I need to have a child for that's not going to be associated with me? Vahaya imba el esha sachiv v'shiches arza levilti nasan zara le'achav. And therefore, Onan said, whenever he is having relations with his wife, he's not going to provide seed for her. So I leave the physics of that to the science textbooks and your imagination. But the point is that Onan made a certain decision not to impregnate his older brother's wife. Vayera be'enei Hashem asher asa. God was not impressed with this decision. Vayamas gam oso. And he also died. God basically killed off Yehuda's two older boys. Killed off the two older boys. When it comes to the second son, we do know why God killed him off. Why did God kill him off? Because he was unwilling to provide seed to his wife. He took on his older brother's widow, but he refused to impregnate her. And that was unacceptable in the eyes of the Almighty. And Rashi tells us, from here we learn the sin of the older son as well. Because the Torah uses this language, Vayera be'enei Hashem asher asa vayamas gam oso. What does the word gam mean? Also, he also killed him off. That seems to create a certain parallel between the two boys. And Rashi says, we see that their sin was the same. Both of them refused to give seed to Tamar. In source number 4, Rashi writes, Kira aso shel onen mashrizaro, that Er and Onan pass away because they refused to give seed to Tamar. Shene amar be'onan vayamas gam oso. Ki misaso shel Er, misaso shel Onan. Just like Er died, Onan died, both of them were unwilling to give seed to Tamar. V'lama haya Er mashkizara. Why was it that they were so unwilling to give seed to Tamar? Don't they want to have children? The answer is, kidei shelo titaber v'yachish yafya. They didn't want to ruin Tamar's beauty. And they thought that if their wife would become pregnant, so she would no longer be beautiful, they didn't want to see the stretch marks, so on and so forth. So I know we joke around about it, but for them it was serious. It was a grave sin. And God kills both boys off. Interestingly, Radak in the next source also sees an allusion to the sin of Er in something that the Torah tells us. Remember, it doesn't tell us by Er why he was killed off by God. It just simply says by Onan that he also died, implying that Er and Onan died for the same reasons. But the Radak says, if you look carefully at the language the Torah uses, back in Pasuk Zayin, it says, Vayhi Er b'chor Yudah ra be'enei Hashem. Er was bad in the eyes of God. What does that tell you? He was only bad in the eyes of God, not bad in the eyes of man, which means that his sin happened in private. So the Radak says, the fact that the Torah tells us that Er was bad in the eyes of God, that is also an allusion to the sin. It was a sin that happened bitsina. It was a sin that happened in privacy. Writes the Radak in source number 5, Vayhi ra b'nei Hashem, shalohaya yodeya bo ela Hashem. It was only God who knew about this sin. It wasn't something that was public. Obviously, Tamar knew about it too. But besides Tamar, this was something that was happening behind closed doors. And so that's the way the Radak also sees the text itself telling us what Er did that was so bad. Yeah, Leah.
I just wanted to say something. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm thinking about it. I said, could they have been really homosexual?
It could be, but the thing is that you get the sense from the text that they had relations with Tamar. It's just that they refused to give her the seed. So if it said they refused to lie with her, it could be that they had a different proclivity and different interests. But you get the sense that they lied with her, it's just they refused to give her the seed, which means that their intent was more malicious. But Leah, it's a good suggestion. Let's talk for a moment or two about that idea of Yibam, and then we're going to move on to the juicier parts, as if this wasn't juicy enough. The truth is, this is the first time I'm even learning this chapter, because in grade school, they always skipped it. I never even knew this existed. I thought, you know, in certain buildings in the area, you go from floor 12 to floor 14. No one wants to live on the 13th floor. It's bad luck. I just thought in Genesis, there was chapter 37 and 39. You know, 38 was just skipped. So the answer is that there is a chapter 38. You just have to be married in order to read it. Okay, so the bottom line is that we do see that Yehuda, after his older son passes away, he sees that, oh, I have to now give Tamar to my next oldest son. That's very interesting that he decided to go ahead and implement what we know as Avhibah. There was no Torah at that point. I mean, it's true that we do know, we have a tradition that the Avos kept the entirety of the Torah, but that was something they did as a Eino Mitzvah V'yosa. They were not formally commanded in any of the mitzvos. They chose to do the mitzvos. What's the greatest proof? And I mentioned it earlier when I was just beginning the class, that the Avos, our patriarchs, were not commanded in mitzvos. The greatest proof is that Yaakov marries Rachel and Leah, two sisters. How could he do that? He's not allowed to do that. The answer is, he's allowed to before Matan Torah. He wasn't allowed to after Matan Torah. So we have to look through a different set of glasses when we're analyzing the actions of our patriarchs, recognizing that they were not formally bound in the mitzvos that you and I are obligated to do. Who else married someone who subsequently you would not be allowed to marry? Amram married his aunt, exactly. Amram married his aunt, which you're not allowed to do after the Torah was given. Yes?
So it's also possible that it was a custom of the land.
Correct.
To do this.
Correct.
Because what would the widow do? She has to go back to her father's house. Maybe she didn't have a father.
Maybe.
It was a way of
Correct. It could have been a nice, courteous, sort of a chivalrous thing to do to a young woman who does not have a husband anymore. Yes? There are different ways of thinking about how the Avos kept the Torah. We know that Hashem gives credit to Avraham. Ekev asher shama Avraham bekoli v'shemor mitzvosai torasai v'chukosai. I'm not quoting verbatim, but Avraham says that, you know, Avraham did keep the Torah, but it certainly was not in a formal sense. It was more of in an informal sense. You know, the Medrash says that Avraham Avinu even kept the halachos of Erev Tavshilin. Erev Tavshilin was a rabbinic enactment made many years later for, you know, for Yom Tov into Shabbos. So you have to assume that the Avos did as much as they could, but it was in a different fashion than it was after Matan Torah. In general, you know, when we do mitzvos today, we only do mitzvos because Hashem gave us the Torah at Har Sinai. If someone says, why do Jews do Bris Milah? And they point to Avram Avinu, that's not correct. Jews do Bris Milah because the Torah was given at Har Sinai, and in Parshas Tazria it says, "V'yom Hashmini yimol b'sar arlaso." The Torah, we don't do Bris Milah because Avram was given Bris Milah. The Rambam has a famous comment in his commentary in Mishnah Chulin, where he says, "Nasna Torah v'nischadisha halacha." The Torah was given, and the halacha was sort of rejuvenated. In other words, we are not formally bound by anything we read in Sefer Bereishis from a halachic perspective. Certainly the morals and the values that come out of Sefer Bereishis we can learn from, but the formal halacha actually doesn't set in until Matan Torah is given. The reason I'm sharing this with you is simply because we have over here an example of a mitzvah being fulfilled, the mitzvah of Yibam. So what exactly was Yehuda thinking? So the Ramban in source number 6, he first begins by quoting Rashi. You know, the Torah tells us that Yehuda goes to his son Onan and he says, you know, you'll have a child, v'hakim zera l'achecha, and we'll have a progeny for your children, v'hakim zera l'achecha. And Rashi, where the Ramban begins by quoting, says, "Haben yikra al-shem hamis." The son will be called on the father's name, Lashon Rashi. That's the point of Yibam. Have a child, Onan, and you'll call that child Er. So that's the point of Yibam. But the truth is, we know that the child doesn't have to be named after the father. The Ramban actually brings this point out. He writes, "Ve'in ze emes." Because when you look in the Torah and Sefer Devarim, you see that same idea. Yakum al shem achiv hames, V'lo yimcha shemo b'Yisrael, and his name will not be forgotten. V'ein hayavam mitzaveh likro livno k'shem achiv ames. But the one who does yibam is not actually obligated to call the child after the one who passed away. Who can think of the greatest, what? First of all, it could be a female. Rus, excellent. Rus has a child. Finally continues the lineage of her husband. What do they name the child? Oved. They don't name the child Machlon. They don't, right? But first of all, the name Machlon means destruction. So we want to try to be a little bit better. It's an interesting scholarly debate whether or not Naomi's two children were actually named Machlon Vekilion. Machlon Vekilion mean death and destruction. I don't know what type of mother names her child. You know, it could be at 3 o'clock in the morning, a few weeks afterwards, she calls the child that. But certainly not when he comes out of the womb. So some scholars say that those were not actually the names of the children. But as we have it, the name of Ruth's husband was Machlon, and yet the name of the child is Oved. So it's not that you actually formally have to name the child after the deceased individual, but conceptually, you continue on with the family through the process of Yibam. So if you turn the page in source number 2, I just want to move through this. Again, this is really setting the stage for what's to come. It's not the integral focus of the shiur today, but you have to understand the basics here. If you look on page number 2, paragraph 2, the Ramban writes, "Aval ha'inyan sod gadol misodos haTorah betoldos Adam." The idea of yibam, the informal idea, not the strict mitzvah, but the more informal idea, is as follows: "V'niker hu le'enei roim asher nasan lahem Hashem inayim liros ve'oznayim lishmo." The Ramban says it's very clear to see. "V'hayu ha'chachamim ha'kadmonim kodem haTorah yodim." The sages, doesn't mean necessarily the rabbinic sages, it just means the wise men of the earlier generations understood ki yesh to'eles gedola b'yibam ha'ach, that there's great benefit to having the brother marry the deceased woman, v'hu ha'ro'i liyos kodem bo, and he should be the first, v'acharav ha'karov b'mishpacha. It's not limited just to the brother. In other words, there is this feeling that a man died young without being able to have children, and it's the family's responsibility to continue on the legacy of the individual passed away. Not necessarily to name the child after the deceased man, but to continue the legacy. The Ramban says it was a primary responsibility on the brother, and then it shifted to the family at large. Ki kol she'ero ha'karov elav mimishpachto, ashehu yoresh nachala, yagiu mimenu to'elas. Anyone in the family that marries the widow, so that person carries on the legacy. It's not limited just to the brother of the deceased. And the Ramban basically goes on to say that this was a common practice. We don't know if it started with Yehuda, who came up with the idea, but it was certainly a general practice even before the Torah was given. If a man died young without seed, without progeny, I should say, so the widow would marry someone else in that family. By the way, Rus also, right? Rus doesn't marry Poloni Amoni. Poloni Amoni wasn't even a brother, but it was someone in the family. There was this sense that someone in the family should continue the legacy of the person that died young. And this is what the Radak writes in source number 7. Nira ki hadavar shel yibum haya mishpat hakadmonim. It was a law of the earlier generations, even before the Torah was given, kodem shenisna haTorah, even before the Torah was given, this was the practice. So now we have sort of set the stage for what is to come. We see that Yehuda, both geographically moves away from his brother, is also demoted in terms of his stature. He marries a Canaanite woman. He has 3 children, Er, Onan, and Shelah. Er, Onan die because they're rotten. They don't want their wife to have stretch marks. They refuse to give seed to their wife. God kills them off. And now we know there's this common custom of marrying the widow off to the next of kin. So who's next? After God has killed off Er and Onan, who comes next? Shelah. But if you are the father of Shelah, how ready are you going to be to give Tamar to this young man? Not. Why? Why not? Bad luck. Exactly. This woman killed off 2 of my two of my sons. I don't know what she's putting in the chillant, right? I don't know what she's putting in the chillant, but something's not right here. And Yehuda is unwilling to marry off his youngest son, even though it was the custom, it was the culture. Keep the seed alive, keep the project, keep the legacy alive. But Yehuda says to himself, this woman is a katlanis. She's killing off my sons. So look at what the Torah records now in source number 8, picking up from where we left off in the text. Vayomer Yehuda l'samar kalaso. Shevi amana beis avich ad yigdal shela. You know what? Go back to your father's home until Shela grows up. Ki amar, because he said to himself, this is internal dialogue. Kan yamos gamhu ke'achav. I'm worried that Tamar is going to kill off my third son like she killed off my two boys. Vatelach Tamar, vateshe beis avia. So she goes back, hoping that she will have the opportunity to marry the third boy. Again, common culture, this was what was happening as far as we can tell. And she has the expectation that she will have yet another chance to have children in this family. Vayirbu hayamim. That Tamas Bashua Ishes Yehuda. Yehuda's wife passes away after a certain amount of time passes on. Vayinachem Yehuda. Yehuda is consoled. He's comforted. Vayal al gozes etzono hu v'chira re'ehu adulami. He and his buddy Chira go. They go towards Timnasa. So basically, the time period of mourning passes on, and he's ready to now go back to the world. So he's going back to his business. He's a shepherd. So he's going to Timnah to shepherd, to check on his flock. Vayugad l'samar lemor. And the word gets to Tamar saying, Hinei chameich ola Timnasa lagoz tzono. So Tamar gets the word that her father-in-law is on his way to Timnah. She realizes that nothing's happening, right? That nobody is going to be bringing her another husband. So she makes the decision to act in a conniving way, in a deceitful way. Vatasar bigdei almunasa me'aleh. She takes off her clothing of a widow. Vatichas batzeif batitzlaf. So basically, she changes her clothing. She covers herself in a scarf. Vateshe bepesach inayim asher al derech Timnasa. She goes to the crossroads, like on your way to Timnah. You went to this like junction, you know. Think about like when you're on those country roads and it says like juncture ahead, right? 22 and 48. That makes sense because it has to be odd and even, right? But 22 and 17 intersect. It was like a major thoroughfare. So Tamar says, "This is where I'm going to go." Ki gadal Shela v'hilo nasna lo lisha. She says to herself, "Shela's already a chassan bacher. He's ready to get married. He's not going to be my husband." So she has to. She has to make a different decision. Vayir'eha Yehuda. Yehuda sees this beautiful woman. Vayachsheveha lezona. He thinks that she's a lady of the night. She's a prostitute. Ki chisesa paneh. Because her face was covered. Now, interestingly, some commentaries say that when it says that she covered her face, it wasn't modifying right now. Think about it. If you're a woman of this elk, and you want to draw customers, you don't draw customers by wearing a burqa. You're going to draw customers by showing off your what you have to offer. Exactly. Oh boy, I'm glad my children aren't here today. Okay, so you have to show off what you have to offer. So some commentaries say that Yehuda didn't recognize her because when she was in her father-in-law's home, she was a tsanua, she was modest. So he didn't get a real good glimpse at her. And only now, when she's sitting at the crossroads trying to get some activity, so she exposes herself. Okay, you could read it one way or the other. Maybe it was the custom in those days that the women who were in the business of harlotry covered themselves a certain way. One way or another, Tamar does a good job of communicating that she's open for business. Vayet eleha el haderech. So Yehuda veers off the road. Vayomer havana. Avo elayech ki lo yada ki chalasohi. He says, "Come to me, sleep with me." He didn't know he was. This woman was his daughter-in-law. Vatomer matitein li kitzavo elay. And she says, "You know what are you going to give me? I cost money." Vayomer anochi ashalach gidi izim atzon. I'll send you some of my flock. Vatomer intetein eravon ad shalchacha. Okay, but give me some sort of collateral that I can ensure that the sheep will come. Remember, he was on his way to check his flock. He didn't have his flock with him. Vayomer maha revona sheretin lach, what can I give you? Vatomer chasomcha upisilecha, give me your signet and your stick, your staff, umatacha, shebiadecha. So give me basically personal objects that I'll hold on to. Vayitain, he gives it to her. Vayitain lo, he gives it to her. Vayavoa leha batahar lo. They have relations and she conceives. Okay, let's stop here and try to analyze. At first glance, we have Tamar acting as a zona, as a prostitute. So we give her negative marks. And we have Yehuda also acting in a way that you would think is somewhat unbecoming of one of the shiftei ka. He's having relations with a prostitute. Again, we have to remember it's before Matan Torah. So we look with a different set of glasses. The idea of a sexual ethic had a different meaning before the Torah is given. And we have to remember that. But we have our work cut out for us, because Lemaisa, we have two individuals acting in a promiscuous way, and we have to ask ourselves, how do we evaluate their actions? What do Chazal say about what has happened? So the first thing I'd like to point out is that Chazal clearly read the psukim that if Yehuda had known that this was his daughter-in-law, he would not have acted. You don't really need the Mefarshim to tell you that, because it's explicit in the Pasuk. If you look back in Source 8, Pasuk Tes Zayin, verse 16, it says, Vayita elel aderech, vayomer vana avoy lecha, ki lo yada, ki chaloso hi. He did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. What's the clear implication of those words? Had he known that this was Tamar, he would have said no thank you. He would have said no thank you. Because whether or not it's formally prohibited, certainly after Matan Torah it's prohibited. Beforehand one could debate. But clearly it was an unbecoming thing for a man to sleep with his daughter-in-law. And therefore, the Torah makes it very clear, had he known, he would not have done so. Had he known, he would not have done so. And the Mefarshim pick up on this. So for example, the Radak in source number 9 writes, Vayireha, her face was covered. V'lo hikira, he could not recognize her. Ba'avor zeh chashva lezona, and because he didn't recognize her, he sized her up that she was a prostitute. Kevan sheyashva beparshas derachim yichida, she was sitting alone at the crossroads. Amar ein zeh lezona, he said to himself, this is a prostitute. She'im lo chisisa paneha, if her face wasn't covered, so he would have recognized that she is her, that she is his daughter-in-law. Bolder words, below Yishkav Ima. Had he known, he would not have slept with her. And then the Radak goes on to say what we said before, that it could be that her face was covered in her father-in-law's house, which is why he didn't recognize her. She was a Tsanua woman. The Svorno, in source number 10, makes this same point, and he actually adds on something fantastic that if you weren't looking carefully, you might have missed entirely. Writes the Svorno in source 10, Gam achar shenata aleha el hadarach, even after he veered off the way to engage her in conversation, lo hikira, he didn't recognize her. Shim haya makira, haya medaber ba beshvil bino. He would have spoken to her about Sheila, he wouldn't have slept with her. So says the Sforno, God orchestrated these events. This is the fantastic comment. Sharatza shiyehe zara mi Yehuda. God wanted the seed to come from Yehuda, not from the boys. God wanted the seed from Yehuda. Shahaya yoser shali. Because he was more whole. He was more worthy than his children. V'ratzoi mishela. Yehuda was more desirable than Yehuda's son Shela. Umimena ye Mashiach tzidkenu. And it's from Yehuda that our Mashiach will come. So the Sforno says this is all happening because God has a plan. God wanted Yehuda to be with Tamar because God wanted Yehuda's direct seed to be the progenitor of the Mashiach. Yes, Bernie.
So all of these people are assuming that God planned for the Mashiach all along.
Correct.
Which means that he also planned for an exile, for destruction of Mashiach.
He told.
It's all in the plan.
Correct. Now, you have to differentiate. There's a difference between God having a plan and God forcing us to do. that subtle dichotomy that we all believe in. In other words, God knows what's going to happen. God has a plan for the Jewish people, but God does not force any one person to go ahead and to do any action. We have Bechira Chavshis. How those two ideas jive with one another is complex. Okay, so I'm going to actually say that in just a minute, Bernie. Give me one moment. I'm going to say that. Give me.
There's a Mishnah that says, "Who had case?"
Right.
How Yaakov came down to right. Egypt right. could have been James or by.
There are all sorts of shluchim amakom. That's correct. God has an endpoint in mind. How we get there, the decisions we make along the way, that is all in man's hand. But it doesn't mean that God doesn't have certain players at the right space to ensure that we get to where we need to go. You know, the most famous example in my mind is that when Yosef gets to that first location where he's supposed to find his brothers and they're not there. So he asks a man, "Where are my brothers?" And Chazal said, you know who that man was? It was the Malach Gavriel. Because God wanted Yosef to keep on going. Had Yosef not found his brothers and returned home, the whole thing wouldn't have happened. So did God force the brothers to sell Yosef? No. But did God make it so that Yosef would actually end up by his brothers and be ultimately sold? The answer is yes. God made sure that Yosef got there. But God did not force the brothers to actually sell Yosef. Okay, I want to move on just for a moment or two. But let's just again take stock in the fact that both the Radak and the Sforno, and it's really the Pasuk itself, make it clear that had Yehuda known that this young lady was his daughter-in-law, he would not have acted the way he did. And that label in Judaism is called shogeg. Shogeg means someone who is acting inadvertently, without intent. So there was no sexual deviance here, the way you and I might have read the story, because clearly Yehuda was unaware what was going on. Not only that, the Medrash and the Gemara both say how Yehuda acted with best of intentions. So I'm going to read you source number 11. I will forewarn you that this is midrashic. This is not meant to be taken literally, okay? So I'm just letting you know that you have to read this upcoming text with a bit of a grain of kosher salt. So the Gemara in source number 11, the Gemara Masechet Sota, reads as follows. Vateshev v'pesach inayim, that she was sitting at the crossroads. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmini Amar, shenasna einayim l'divareha. That put her eyes into the matter. What exactly does that mean? You'll see. Basically, Tamar answered the questions correctly. Kishativa'a amarla. When Yehuda was beginning to engage in this relationship, he asked her, Shema nachris at? Are you a non-Jewish woman? Amarle giyoresani. Don't worry, I'm a converted woman. Again, I say that it's not. There was no conversion, no sense of real conversion before Matan Torah. So it's not meant to be taken literally. But that's what the Gemara says. Shema Eshesh Ish Ata. Yehuda says, maybe you're a married woman, in which case I would not be interested in hiring you for your services. Amrulei Penuya Ani. Don't worry, I am not a married woman. Shema Kibel Beich Avich Kedusha. Maybe your father married you off unbeknownst to you, or I guess that wouldn't be a valid question because she wouldn't know, but maybe your father married you off. Amrulei Yisoma Ani. Don't worry, I'm an orphaned woman. Nobody has married me off. Shema Tmeyaat. Maybe it's the time of menstruation and you are impure. Amrulei Tahora Ani. I am pure. So what are the rabbis doing over here? I don't think the rabbis are necessarily telling us that Yehuda inquired whether or not this prostitute was a Nida or not. I don't think that that's what they're getting at. I think what they're trying to tell us over here is that Yehuda acted with the purest of intentions. Yehuda was a single man, and he inquired of this woman, "Are you single as well?" Remember, we're looking at this story with pre-Matan Torah glasses. The sexual ethic was different than it is nowadays. And the idea of engaging a woman for a short-term sexual pleasure wasn't as off-limits as you and I perceive it. Even nowadays, I don't think it's so off-limits anymore. But conceptually, what Chazal are getting at is that Yehuda acted with a certain measure he was deliberate. He was asking her, "Are you a married woman? Did your father marry you off?" He didn't just simply say, "Hey, you lady, come here, let's sleep together." there was a measure, there was a calculated measurement in Yehuda's actions. And the way Chazal get that through is through these series of questions. Whether or not Yehuda actually asked Tamar, are you a convert? I actually don't think that happened. It doesn't make sense to say that happened. But that's what Chazal are trying to, that's the point Chazal are trying to bring out through this conversation. Yes?
Did he ask her everything else? Did he ask her name?
I don't know. Right. But she, I mean, listen, if she's trying to dupe him, she could have said, my name is Sarah, whatever. Right? If, well, you know, so let me just show you one other source that also comes to the aid of Yehuda trying to defend him further. In source number 12, the language of the pasuk, Vayet Aleha El Haderech, he veered toward her. Listen to this. Unbelievable. Madrash and Bereshis Rabbah. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Bikesh La'avor. Yehuda wanted to go on. He was interested in checking his stock. He, literally, his stock, right? He wanted to know what's going on with the sheep. Bikesh La'avor, he wanted to pass over this shady crossroads. Vizime lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Malach. But God invited a malach to be at that moment, Shehu Memuna al Hataiva. This was the malach of Taiva. This was the malach of Taiva. What? The malach of lust, exactly. It was the malach of lust. If I wasn't a rabbi, I would make some cute jokes here about pharmaceutical companies and drug names, but I'm not going to. Amar lo Yehuda. So Yehuda said, Heichan Amar lo, sorry, the Malach said to Yehuda, Yehuda, Heichan ata holich, where do you think you're going? Says this angel of lust. Holich meheichan melachim omdim. Where are you going? You're going to the place where kings stand. Meheichan gidolim omdim. You are going to the place where great men stand. And that's the meaning of the pasuk, Vayet aleha el hadarech. The Malach, God, basically forced Yehuda off the road, Ba'al Korcho, against his will, Shelo B'Tovaso. That wasn't necessarily for his good. Obviously it was for his good, because God wanted Yehuda to sleep with Tamar. But what's the Medrash getting at? The Medrash is getting at is that Yehuda was not the type of character that would willy-nilly decide to just go sleep with a prostitute. That was not him. He was one of the Shifteka. One of the 12 tribes of Yaakov. This was an extraordinarily unusual moment that God needed to make happen. That's the best I can say. Now, we can't remove all, quote-unquote, guilt from Yehuda. In other words, he is responsible for his actions. That's axiomatic to our belief system. God does not force anyone's hand, except for Paro and maybe one other character in Tanakh. But as a general rule, God does not force us to act. However, God can make a situation nearly impossible to get out of. And that's really what the Medrash is getting at, is that Yehuda was not this type of person, but he was overcome with lust at this moment. Tamar was a beautiful woman, he saw her, and even though his intention was not originally to go ahead and sleep with the woman, he was placed in an environment when it was nearly impossible to move beyond because God wanted this to happen. Going back to this morning, God wanted there to be a direct seed of Yehuda in Tamar in order to ultimately set the stage for Melech HaMashiach. So I think we have done a good job of defending, quote-unquote, Yehuda. He wasn't making some impetuous, irrational decision driven by lust. In the end of the day, it might have been, but it was not his intention, and it was only because God threw these factors into the mix to really draw Yehuda to Tamar. Yes?
But how did he know she was a beautiful woman if her face was covered?
Okay, so I guess you could start. Yeah.
But I wanted to know why, if he didn't want his son to marry her, he wanted to have someone in his family,
right?
He should have volunteered.
Interesting, but maybe he was afraid of her. Maybe he was really afraid that she's...
But if he feels that this is... God's will.
How much was he really aware there was God's will? We see from Chazal that they understood there was God's will. Whether or not Yehuda saw that this was God's will, I don't know. Exactly, yeah. Okay, so we have one more section to cover. We have Baruch Hashem defended Yehuda as much as possible. Now we have to ask ourselves about Tamar. We have to ask ourselves, what was in it for Tamar? Was she simply a desperate woman looking to have a child, and therefore engage in this type of deceptive behavior so someone would impregnate her? Or was there something deeper going on? Now clearly, if she just simply wanted to have children, so she could have acted as a prostitute and had anybody sleep with her and impregnate her. clearly we can already see at the outset that there was a deeper motivation involved. What was that motivation? So we have to look at the source. So look with me in source number 13. The Torah tells us, Vatakam, Vatelach, Yehuda gets up and he goes, and Tamar goes on her way, Vatatzar Tzi'ifa Me'aleha, she takes off that extra covering she put on to act as the prostitute, Vatilbash Bigdei Al-Menusa, and she puts back on her clothing that she was wearing as a widow. Vayishlach Yehuda Sgidi Ha'izim B'yad Re'ehu Adulami, La'kachas Ha'iravo Mi'ad Ha'isha. And Yehuda makes good on his promise. He wants to send over the sheep that he said he would. The problem is, v'lo matza'a. He could not find her. She was gone. Vayishal es anshei mekoma lemor. So this man who was representing Yehuda asks around. He says, Ayeh HaKadesha, where is this prostitute? He be'enayim ala derech, who sits at the crossroads. Vayomru, and they said to him, lo haisa bazeh kadesha. There was never such a woman in this town. This, you got, you know, sir, what do you take us for? There was never such a woman in this area. Vayashav el Yehuda vayomer lo mitzasiya v'gamen shem akom amru lo haisa bazeh kadesha. And Chira goes back. He says, Yehuda, I don't know what you were thinking about, but there was nobody here. Nobody recognizes such a woman. I don't know what to tell you. Okay. Vayomer Yehuda tikach la penel lebuz hine shalachti agidi hazeh v'ata lo mitzasa. Okay, but you hold on to it because I don't want the word getting out that I don't pay my debts. So this will be the payment. We'll set it aside. Vayhi kimishosh chadashim. And it was around 3 months. What happens when you're pregnant around 3 months? You have that little baby bump, as they say. Vayugad Yehuda lemor, and the word came to Yehuda saying, Zansa Tamar Kalasech, your Kalasecha, your daughter-in-law clearly was Mizana, she was promiscuous. Vigam Hine Hara Lezinunim, she was impregnated as in a promiscuous way, like Zona Zinunim. Vayomer Yehuda, and Yehuda says, Hotziuha Vetisareif, we have to kill her. To kill her. Why do you have to kill her? Killer strafa is burning, to burn her. So Rashi says in source number 14, quotes from someone very unusual. Amar Ephraim Mikasha'a. Yeshua Rabbi Meir, I'm not familiar with this individual, but Rashi quotes from someone who says, Bitel Shel Shem Haisa. She was the daughter, might not have been literally the daughter, the granddaughter of Shem, what? A Kohen, exactly. Kohen. We consider Shem to be of somehow a Kohen, not a formally a Kohen. Again, Kohen, Kohanim, as we know, would start with Aaron. But he was known as like a priest. We see that there are other characters in Sefer Bereishis that are known as priests. Shehu Kohen, Lefikach, Danua B'Sreifa. Therefore, we have to treat this woman as the daughter of a priest, as the daughter of a priest who was promiscuous. So we have to burn her. Because after all, once the Torah is given, we have a halacha that if a daughter of a priest is promiscuous after she's married, we burn her. So that's what Yehuda says. Remember, Yehuda was generally familiar with the laws of the Torah. We're going to apply the same halachos. So you have to burn Tamar at the stake. Burn her for her promiscuous activity. What? Ah, so very good. So the truth is, the Sifsei Chachamim, that's a very good point. The Sifsei Chachamim in source 15 says exactly your question. He says, Vim Tomar, Lama Chayva B'Sreifa. Why would we burn her? Ha lav nisua haisa. She wasn't a fully married woman. V'gam lo mu'urasa haisa. Nor was she betrothed. We know in Judaism there are two stages of marriage. There is erusin and nisuin. But Tamar was neither. She was what we call in halacha a shomeres yavam. Someone waiting for the yavam to marry her. By the way, if a shomeres yavam does act in a promiscuous way, she's not burned, even according to the laws of the Torah. So why does Yehuda react in such a strong manner? So he writes, V'yesh lomar, delakach danua b'misa, kedei la'ayim al habrios. What does that mean, la'ayim al habrios? We want to make an example. We want to scare the people. Shelo yifritzu hador v'yikalkalu. Because we have to be very careful about promiscuity. We know from already times of Noah that people act in a promiscuous way and the world was completely destroyed. And then we know from that point on, even the Gentiles tried to be careful with promiscuity. So the Sifsei Chachamim is explaining that this was not actually a halachic ruling, which would make sense because we are before Matan Torah, but Yehuda thought that what she did was so despicable, we have to make an example of her. So burn her at the stake so that people don't act in a promiscuous fashion. if there was a reason to come to the shir, it was to read the next source. An unbelievable idea. Unbelievable. The Baal HaTurim quotes from Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. Listen to this in source number 16. Rabbeinu Yehuda HaChassid Piresh. Delo dana oso Yehuda l'sreifa. Nobody was going to burn her at the stake. Ella sheyisrefu la roshem bein paneha. They were going to take some sort of hot rod and give her a symbol on her face. Lisimin shehi zona. Is that unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen? Scarlet letter. Exactly. I think this is amazing because it's a game changer. We're all generally familiar with the story. But to see that one of the biblical commentaries say that it was never Yehuda's intent to actually burn her. It was never his intention to burn her. It was simply he was going to give her a little mark. So she would be known as like a harlot. The scarlet letter. The scarlet letter. This is a precursor to the scarlet letter. But that's a very interesting read and it's very different. One way or the other, clearly Yehuda is furious. I think the pshat seems to indicate that he was going to kill her for her promiscuous acts, but keep this one in the back pocket. If you have to say a Dvar Torah at the Shabbos table and there are no children around, you can give this Dvar Torah that everybody thinks that Yehuda wanted to kill Tamar. But the truth is, he just wanted to give her a mark that would identify her as a Zona. But the bottom line is, Yehuda reacts in a very, very harsh way. He thinks she should be severely punished. Yeah, Gladys.
He sent her back to her father's house.
Right.
She's her father's daughter.
Right.
Where is he suddenly entering this picture? Unless it's God pushing.
Well, God, what you're saying, where does she... Well, I mean, she hears that he's coming. She realizes that nobody is going to bring her Shelah. And she has to do something. And this is really where we see Chazal explaining her intentions in even more of a pure way. In source number 17, going back to the point we made earlier, regarding the fact that she covered her face even in her father's home. So the Gemara Masechet Sota says as follows: Vayira Yehuda ve'achshevel zona ki chisasa paneh. That's the pasuk that Yehuda sees her and he thinks she's a prostitute because she covers her face. The Gemara says mishum dechisasa paneh achshevel zona. She covers her face and suddenly he thinks she's a prostitute. It's usually just the opposite, right? The more exposed you are, the more it speaks about what your intentions are. So what's the connection? Amar Rabbi Elazar, shechisasa paneha bebeis chameha. No, she covered her face in her father's home. She was at Tzanua. The Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmini Amar Rabbi Yonasan, kolkala shehi Tzanua bebeis chameha. Any bride that is modest in her father-in-law's home, zocha v'yotzin mimena, Milachim v'neviim. That woman will be Zocha, will merit to be the progenitor of kings and prophets. Minalan, where we know this from? Mitamar. So we see Chazal think about Tamar in the highest regard. They don't think about her as some despicable, promiscuous lady, but they think about Tamar as the model of what a tsanua, of what a modest woman's behavior should look like. And the Rishami says this point about her modesty and her good intentions in even more of a strong way. The Rishami in source number 18, Vatesha bePesach Inayim, she sat at the crossroads. Says the Rishami, "V'chi Efshar Kain? You're going to tell me that Tamar, our modest Tamar, sat at the crossroads? V'halo afilu zona shebezonos eina osa Kain. Even the most promiscuous of women don't act in such a fashion, sitting, waiting for a man to come at the crossroads. Ella, so what is the meaning of this pasuk? Shetilsa eineha lepesach. She lifted up her eyes, pesach einayim. She opened up her eyes." Shekol ha'inayim mitzuposlo, to the person that everybody looks at. Who does everybody look to? To the Ribbono Shel Olam. Vatesha v'pesach einayim, means she lifted up her eyes to the heavens. Amra lefanav, and she says, Ribbono Shel Olam, master of the universe. Al etzei reikam min habayis hazeh. Don't let me leave. What's reikam? Reikam is empty. Don't let me leave empty from this home. She says, Hashem, I want to be involved in this family. And this is my lot. I wasn't married into Reuben's family or Shimon's family or God's family. This is my family. Hashem, give me seed. Let me be a progenitor of great men and women from this family. So Vatesha Bepesach Einayim, says the Gemara, means that she sat and she davened. not that she sat and exposed herself. I mean, she did that too, because she had to bring in Yehuda. But on a deeper level, she was sitting there and davening, Hashem, please, please, don't let me leave empty-handed. And Rabbi Avram Rivlin, in the sefer that I mentioned last week, a wonderful sefer, he points out that the word reikam has resonance for us in other contexts as well, about women who feel deprived of being able to join in the Messianic family. Megillas Rus in source number 19. This is when Naomi comes back finally, right? She says, Ani meleya halachti, I left full with my boys, my husband, ready to contribute to the Jewish people. Ve reikam heshivani. But now I return empty. So says Rabbi Rivlin that this connection should not be ignored. That the fact that the Medrash uses this language, remember, Tamar herself doesn't say those words as we know it, it's not included in the Torah, but when Chazal are scripting the words that she uses to daven, what word in particular do they pick? Reikam. And where are they drawing that from? They are drawing it from when Naomi comes back. And she's now coming back, bereft of her husband and her two boys. She uses that same language, reikam. I wanted to have a role in being a progenitor of the Messiah and being part of the Jewish people, and now I'm empty. And we see that word also appear a little bit later on in Perek Gimel when Boaz agrees to help Ruth. At that point, they were yet married, but when he sends her back, after that night in the threshing floor in source 20, Vatomer Shesha Sori Ma'ila Nasan Li. So Rus, this is actually when Rus is telling her mother-in-law what happened. So Boaz gave me all this food. Ki amare lai al tavoi rekam el chamosich. Because Boaz says, don't come back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. But again, Rabbi Rivlin says it doesn't mean physically empty-handed. It means Boaz was sending a message to Naomi that you will not be reikam. You will not be empty-handed. You too will have a child. It might not be your biological child, but it will be identified as your child, right? Everyone says at the end of Megillah, Naomi has a child. So you will not be reikam. And it says Rabbi Rivlin, that's why when the Gemara Yushami is crafting the language, the tefillah of Tamar, she says, Al etzei reikam min habayis hazeh, don't leave me empty from the child. She's davening. She also wants to have a hand in bringing about the Mashiach. And two other sources, and then we'll conclude. The Medrash in source 21 makes a fascinating parallel that I also believe speaks volumes about what Tamar's intentions were. Who else covers herself and has twin boys? Who else?
Rivka.
Right? We know that when Rivka first sees Yitzchak in the distance, the Torah tells us that she covers herself. And she too. Okay, so that's in the midst. There are different midrashim. I appreciate that. Three-year-olds were much more mature in those days. So in source number 21, it says like this: Vatasar bigdei amunusa, vatasar bigdei amunasa me'aleh vatichas betzif. She takes off her clothes of a widow and she covers herself. Writes the Medrash, vaticha as follows. Shtayim heim shenitchasu betzif. There were two women that covered themselves with a garment. Tamar v'Rivka. V'shteihem yiladu toamim. And both of them had twins. Rivka v'tikach chatzif v'titchas. Tamar v'tikach v'tichas v'tzif v'titala. So we see both women are compared to each other. What do you make of that? Well, when you're compared to someone of righteous merit, so we also know that that's a good thing for you too. To be considered like someone else of great righteousness speaks volumes about who you are. And that is clearly what the Medrash is doing. When she covered herself, she was acting like one of the matriarchs. So we have to see Tamar's actions not as some desperate ploy to have a child because no one's going to marry her, but Tamar felt that these are the people that I want to be associated with. And she felt that she needed to have a role in the Jewish people. Unfortunately, she felt that she needed to do so in a deceitful way, but she clearly felt that there was no other option. Let me just finish one last source. The Zohar, I don't usually go with Zohars, but Rabbi Rivlin quoted the Zohar, and I found it, so I'm happy to share with you. The Zohar also speaks in praiseworthy terms about Tamar. Shtei nashim hayu shmehem hitpashet zera Yehuda. Two women of note had names associated with the tribe of Yehuda, the Yatza Mehem, David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech, and Melech HaMashiach. And these two women are responsible for being the progenitors of David, Solomon, and the Messiah. The Elu Shtei HaNashim, Domim Zulazu. And these two women are similar to one another. Tamar Virus. Shemesu Ba'aleim HaRishonim. Both of them suffered the loss of their first husbands, right? Tamar and Rus both lost husbands. Vehem Ba'atzman Hishtadlu Lo'osa HaMaisa. And both women had to be involved in some sort of deceit, if you will, in order to bring about their children. And Rus had to put on her beautiful, elegant clothing and then sneak into the threshing floor and stay by Boaz's feet. We talked about that on Shavuos. Umishtei Elu Nivne v'hishtak lel zera Yehuda v'shteyem b'kashrus asu. Let's look at those last two words. V'shteyem b'kashrus. Both of them acted with kosher motivation. So we have a story here that at surface level seems filled with promiscuity and actions that we're not proud of. But when you dig deeper, you see that there was actually a lot of merit. There was a tremendous amount of self-sacrifice and courage, really, certainly on the part of Tamar, to do what she did. Halakhically speaking, it would be very hard to tell you that she actually did wrong. Before Matan Torah, a lot more leeway is given. It's hard to point to Yehuda as actively sleeping with his daughter-in-law. He didn't know it was his daughter-in-law. Had he known, he would have stopped. And was he really interested in it? No, the Malach had to come and shove him off the path and make him feel lustful, because otherwise that was not his regular way. That was not the way he was generally acting. And Tamar too. She wasn't interested in simply a one-night stand, a fling with her father-in-law. She felt that she had a stake here in the Melech HaMashiach. And just to end with what we began with, that is why Chazal say that as dark and as sad as these moments were for the Jewish people, ultimately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu haya oseg borei oro shemelech HaMashiach. Ultimately, it was God that was acting behind the scenes, sowing the light to bring about the Melech HaMashiach. So we'll stop over here for this class. And Yiratz Hashem, next week, we will focus on David and Bathsheba. And then the fourth class will be, why in general do we have to have all of this scandalous behavior leading up to David and Mashiach? Thank you.